Welcome to the What's Your Problem podcast. I'm your host, Amy Bull, and I'm joined today by Andrew Sid Salmon from DWG. Welcome.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you.
We talked the other day on the phone about your name, and I think for some of our viewers or our listeners, they'll be wondering who I'm talking to today.
So I think today you'll talk to Sid. Sid is my nickname in the industry. I've had it for about 30 years. So I've worked in digital over 30 years before it was even termed digital. And I got that because one of my first employers, small business, small kind of, at least an office, okay, and out of the five of us, three were called Andrew. And one day, one of the guys got fed up of saying Andrew, and everybody was responding. And he named us, I can't remember what he named us actually, but I think it was Dick, Wally, and Sid. So I actually, Amy, got away with it quite lightly because I could have been Dick, right, or Wally, and I don't particularly want to have a nickname like that. And that was it. And because it was quite small, and at the time the internet was relatively, you know, kind of embryonic at that point, it stuck. So, and, you know, the organization itself was a company called CompuServe, I mean, back in the day. And it acted a bit like a university. So people coming into the, you know, the internet very early days and stuff like this, you know, those kind of early adopters or, you know, those people who wanted to work in this type of industry were kind of attracted to it. There weren't too many businesses at that point. I'm literally trying to think who was around and completely forgetting who was about at that particular point. That, you know, kind of bulletin boards and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't really very many bigger companies, you know, in 1993. So I'm showing my age at this point. So anyway, it kind of stuck. And actually, I stayed with CompuServe and AOL because CompuServe was eventually acquired by AOL for about 6 years. So quite a few people came and went. The internet obviously took off at that particular time. I then went to Dell Online for a period. I thought I'd lost Sid at that point. I lost him for about 3 weeks until they employed somebody who was from CompuServe. And then they said, oh, Sid, what are you doing here? And everybody said, well, are they calling you Sid? And then it was at that point I thought, I'm just going to give up, actually. I'm just literally going to give up and embrace Sid. And that's what it's been for 30 years. Everybody kind of in the industry now. So when I'm at work, everybody, you know, says Sid. And the only people who really call me Andrew these days is my wife and my family. So I know when somebody rings up and says Andrew there, then I know they're at least either going to be part of the family or don't know me at all. Okay? And then eventually they will call me Sid. Yeah, there we go.
You know you're in trouble when you get called Andrew then. Is that what you're telling me?
I do indeed. I must admit, I'm not an Andy. So a lot of people, unless my very best mates, they call me Andy just because they actually wind me up and they know it winds me up. But apart from that, yes, I know I'm probably going to be in trouble if it's Andrew for the day rather than Sid.
So talk to me a little bit about what DWG do right now. So for people that don't know who you are, what do you do?
Do you know, it's a really interesting question, okay? And I think like lots of businesses over a period of time, and it's actually one of the learnings that might come out of this, is it takes quite a lot of time and thought to actually be absolutely precise about what you do. And a lot of smaller businesses, you know, are very tempted at times to do as much as they possibly can do. And it is a real balance between being really focused and also actually being quite broad in your approach. And some stuff, of course, it's really attractive to be broad because actually if you're more generalist, you know, you have more chances of riding out some of the waves and stuff like that. But we're now really clear what we do. Well, we hope we are, and actually what we're good at. So I think part of the clue is in the name. So DWG stands for Digital Works Group.
Yeah.
Okay. We're really good at complicated change for clients. So, you know, a lot of clients say that digital transformation or digital data, AI, technology transformation is one of the most important things that they do. And that's quite ubiquitous, actually, across multiple sectors and also multiple businesses. So lots of people are aware these days, actually investing appropriately in technology has some benefits. And, you know, there's lots of stats. So if you look mm-hmm. at all of the, you know, the research coming out from organizations like KPMG or Deloitte or Capgemini or whatever, let's call it digital transformation because that's mm-hmm. a little easier. Digital transformation ranks pretty much at the top in terms of importance mm-hmm. that most organizations are trying to achieve at this particular point in time. In fact, the government is a really good example of that. Maybe we'll come onto that a little bit later. But the sad thing about it is most of these transformations, they're quite complex because mm-hmm. a lot of these kind of big disruptive technologies are pervasive through the organization. And organizations are poor at really broad change.
Mm-hmm.
So often digital transformations only succeed, believe it or not, 3 times in 10. So okay. they have a very high degree of failure rate.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a CEO, that's a very awkward position to be in. So you're there with your C-level team and you think, oh, okay, this is the most important thing we're trying to achieve, but actually we're not very good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it has a very high level of, you know, being unsuccessful over that period. Now,
and what do you think the reasons are for that? Is that because people aren't skilled in project management or program management? Is it because they don't really understand what they're trying to achieve?
I think it's all of those things, actually. I think often, you know, technology is seen as technology for technology's sake.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I'm sure you've done this yourself, but when you actually deploy a piece of technology, is the technology isn't the thing which gives you the problems. Sadly, it's us, it's mm-hmm. humans, okay? So technology generally, as I've just said, does what it's told,
mm.
okay? And it's much more definitive in actually when you deploy it. Now, of course, within businesses, there's only two real things which actually run your business. One is a piece of technology,
mm-hmm.
the other one is a human.
Mm-hmm.
Now, humans, when they're interacting with technology or whatever, or going through change, are often very fearful of it, especially if they see a piece of disruptive technology and they think, well, hold on a minute, you know, I'm not, you know, most people are not dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And they fundamentally see what the impact of that technology is and they get very fearful for, I think, a couple of reasons. So there's a very practical fear to start with, which is actually, is it going to take my job?
Mm-hmm.
That's a big thing with AI yeah. at the moment.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, am I going to lose some status?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people who have been in business for quite a long period of time, mm-hmm. especially in the senior leadership positions, and a piece of thing comes in and then they think, well, okay, I don't really know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know what it's going to do for the business. As often, I don't have the answers around this. So they get fearful that actually their status starts to get eroded because
mm-hmm.
actually most people's statuses are actually built when an organization's in a kind of state of being for a period of time rather than a state of change.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
So there's natural fear comes into this. And I don't know, you know, I'm not going to quote Star Wars or anything like that, but, you know, fear leads to hate and all of these types of stuff. But it sets the scene, I think, for a certain kind of mindset that mm-hmm. actually these things come in and what does it really mean for me?
Mm-hmm.
Because humans are very personal, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, we are driven by, you know, what does it really mean for me? Yes, of course, you know, I'm a senior leader and I can broadly see the benefit to the, you know, the overall organization. But actually, I'm really also thinking, what does it really mean for me at this particular point mm-hmm. in time? And often companies don't address that well.
Mm-hmm.
So they address the project management,
mm-hmm.
If they have the governance,
mm-hmm. it's
surprising the amount of organizations which don't have the governance to mm-hmm. be able to do these things. They may even address the strategy. They might say, well, okay, this is what we need to do as a business, and we're going to weave these things appropriately into what we're going to do. I can tell you most organizations don't do that particularly well either, okay? But the fundamental thing they always, or many organizations don't get right, is to focus on the human journey
mm-hmm.
and the business change activity to that. So when you know, you combine a number of things. So, you know, maybe they haven't got the strategy worked out. Maybe they've underestimated what they need to do mm-hmm. in terms of money, time, and human effort. Have they worked out the governance processes?
Mm-hmm.
have they worked out, you know, as I've just said, the kind of human aspects to it? And there's about, in our experience, we've come across about 9 or 10 core characteristics, which would either, you know, push it in the right direction or not.
Mm-hmm.
One of those is skills, which you mentioned. And that actually contributes to why often this is not, you know, although it's important, it often fails.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, for a lot of C-level people in the business, that's a really awkward place to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Because what they want to be doing is seen to be doing the right thing, doing a good job, moving the business forward, making sure that it's buoyant.
Being good leaders.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And actually being, you know, the people to go to because that's what they've done over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've, you know, maybe, you know, we've distilled why we're good at it. So, you know, we worked out, and this is relatively recent, okay, we did some analysis on how many kind of transformations we've helped with, okay, and they can be, going to sound a bit like Goldilocks at the moment, they can be kind of small, medium and large in that respect. And although it's a little bit more complicated than this picture, but it fundamentally boils down to three main things, okay. So the first thing, I think, why we... why we can, you know, raise the dial from about 30%. Actually, through our research, we've succeeded. We've done 180 plus. We've succeeded 94% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite a big change. So to go from 30 to 94%, that's not a bad message, actually, for a CEO, because at that point it's important and it's likely to succeed, rather than it's important and not likely to succeed. And as I said, one of the things, as I said, we kind of boil down why we're good at it. The main one is, or at least the main one of the main building blocks associated with it, is we've worked out kind of blueprints and playbooks and methodologies which are kind of scenario-driven. Okay, so an organization may come to us and say, we need to digitally transform our go-to-market, our kind of sales and marketing team. And we go, yeah, we've got one of those. Okay, this is why you should do it. This is what you're going to change, and this is how you're going to do it. And that's really important, okay, because as I say, if you have a, you know, it's like driving a car. If you hop in the car and you start driving, what's your chances of getting to the destination you really want to? If you have a sat and have a map, okay, you have a much better chance of doing it. It's the same thing with just a business change blueprint. It gives you a much better guidance about what you should be doing and broadly in what order as well, and, you know, some of the characteristics that you need as well. And maybe that increases the dial from 30% to 45% success. It's clearly not all of the answer. A map is only as good as the people reading the map and then doing something with it, okay? So the second thing I think we've, you know, we've come to a conclusion, which is really important, and you touched on this already, which is you've got to have the right skills and you've got to have the right experience, okay? And complex change is pretty complicated. I mean, it's called that for a reason, right? Because it crosses lots of functions within a business. But the other thing, and we've already touched on this, it's really complicated because you've got to take all of the tribe and the humans in the business with you. All of them, sometimes, or hopefully, sometimes not all of them, depending where their mindset is. But you need to have people who understand the kind of the technical domain. So what, you know, what is blockchain, or what is digital, or what is data, and what is AI? It's the biggest one of the lot, okay? But you also need to understand how you do complex change as part of that. And we're really lucky, okay? We've got people in their 40s and 50s who are good at, have been doing complicated change for a long time. They also understand the technology. But the other secret sauce bit is they understand the human aspect of it. So they're pretty good. They've got good EQs, right? And you generally, although this is a big generalization, you generally do that as you get a little bit older. So you need to have a little bit of maturity and do it quite often. And it really helps if you've, and this is a bit controversial, you've not been a consultant all of your life. You've actually been in the shoes of the C-level team, So you absolutely understand the context mm-hmm. of the problems that they've got. Because it's not just, oh, can you deploy a piece of technology? It's always much more, we've heard about it, we've much more complex kind of environmental aspects you do. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of our clients is a big governmental department, 60,000 employees, as you would expect, okay? Fairly political, as mm-hmm. element of that. And we were very successful of actually deploying there and, getting buy-in for, defining it and getting buy-in for their data enterprise strategy. Big element of that isn't about defining the data enterprise strategy, it's getting the buy-in. That's the difficult part of it, okay? So if you've got people who understand the context, you've got a little bit more experienced, by definition as well, unfortunately, C-level people tend to be, in 40 and 50 age group and maybe slightly older. Mm-hmm. They respond to people of that age group slightly better, mm-hmm. okay? You add all of those factors together, contextual knowledge, knowledge of stakeholder management, all of the other stuff I've already said, okay? It probably de-risks it a little bit more because you know how to get stuff done. So it's not, I've read it in a book. Mm-hmm. I actually know how to do it in reality.
Is there a risk, though, that with that kind of element, you're focusing on that kind of, I guess, age group? And if we start getting into millennials and Gen Z and Gen X and all of those kind of things, is about how the communication works with those individual groups?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a risk for us. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we're good at what we're doing in the window we're operating in today. Mm-hmm. So, being a, what am I, a Gen X? Am I a Gen X?
You're not a boomer, are you?
No, I'm not quite there yet. That's passed me by, right? But I think I'm Gen X. And I think because of that, a lot of people at the most senior positions are now Gen Xers. Mm-hmm. So by definition, I'm hoping at least, we know how to do that. Now, mm-hmm. over a period of time, that will be supplanted by millennials and whatever, and they will have a very different viewpoint in the way that they're operating. Mm-hmm. But where we are trying to do most influence is up at the C-level team, at least mm-hmm. to start with, because they set the culture and the tone and the direction mm-hmm. of the company, and we can't get away from that. Mm-hmm. Even how collegiate an organization mm-hmm. may be, they're still doing that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, when we focus in that area, but we also have to be mindful that actually people doing the implementation associated with that might be of a slightly different kind of attitude and kind of knowledge base. I'll come on to that in a minute.
I think that's the challenge always, isn't it, is keeping your workforce relevant for your clients in terms of experience, age, and likability, because we buy off people that we like, right?
It's people we trust.
Trust.
It's all about trust.
Yeah.
It really boils down to, I work in sales, mm-hmm. right? So when we're going through, the process, when we're, trying to think about a client scenario, we are thinking, is there a need we can do, obviously? Mm-hmm. Is there money? Mm-hmm. Is it urgent, ideally? Mm-hmm. But most importantly, can we build trust? Mm-hmm. Actually, because a lot, as I said, these are really, we heard earlier, these are really important activities. So I'm not just going to give it to anybody, because if they don't do it, this is career-ending activity, right, for them. Because if it fails and they've spent lots of money on it and there's no return, then their mm-hmm. shareholders or whoever, the CEO or the C-level team's bosses are, it typically is, a bunch of shareholders, they're not going to be very happy about the scenario, right? So it's a big bet for them. Mm-hmm. They have to go to organizations that they trust, mm-hmm. okay? And part of that is likability, of course, mm-hmm. in that regard. But as I said, we've got a fairly strong narrative these days, I think, that we can kind of say, we've done quite a lot of this. Mm-hmm. We've made mistakes. Mm-hmm. We've learned a lot of lessons. We actually, again, when you employ people in their 40s and 50s, you generally make more mistakes in your 20s and early 30s than you do in your 40s and 50s because mm-hmm. you've learned, mm-hmm. ideally, okay? So one of our favourite lines is, we've made mistakes on somebody else's dollar, not yours, in that regard. So that's useful mm-hmm. in that respect. So when you've got, you know, they can't have the right skills and the right capabilities. And I'll go on to behaviours just in a sec, because that's the most important one of the lot, okay? And you've got really good partner ecosystem. So we're an organisation and a consulting business of 40-odd people, okay? But we have a big, extensive partner ecosystem of 25, you know, strategic partners we work with, given what we do as a business, okay? And they're of the same kind of mindset and everybody to us. So you add all of those capabilities and skills, and that de-risks it a little bit more. So you go from that 45%, say, to 65%.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the magical 30%? Okay. It's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the killer bit. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, we've looked at all of the kind of the successful behaviors, and you can say, yes, of course, you know, an orientational quality is brilliant, and a continuous improvement as part of that. And yes, you're you're embedding things like adaptability and agility, and, you know, you're completely customer focused and centric. And I really believe in that last one, by the way. Okay. But that's all wrap to a certain extent, possibly apart from the customer focus. And I'll explain that in a minute. But we've actually boiled down the real behavioral success actually to three primary things that we're good at. I think the first one is we're really outcome focused. So we always ask clients, what do you want to kind of get out of this, and what are the business benefits? You know, as I said earlier, some organizations start with the position is we're just going to deploy the technology and hope it solves our problem. That's rubbish. Okay, it doesn't work. So you have to kind of work out what it's going to do for you, okay, and then use that as your destination. Mm-hmm. So talking about our blueprints before, yep, that guide your blueprints. So we're really outcome focused and business benefit focused, and actually that's normally quite strong music for a CEO's ears, because that's what they're going to be targeted on in terms of success. Then the other thing we do is we work as one team with a client. Okay, so the old traditional consulting model would be, I tell you what, we've understood your problem. Maybe we have thought about what business benefits you want. We're going to go away. We're going to wrap a towel around our head in a darkened room for 6 weeks. And we're going to come out with a solution. And then we're going to tell you what the solution is.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do that at all. So we work actively through the, if you want to call it, you know, the kind of the discovery, design and deployment phases as one team with the client, and also really importantly with their core suppliers. So egos are left at the door, okay, completely. So everybody, this is what we need to achieve. This is the business benefit we're going to achieve. And as one team, we're going to do that, okay. The final thing we actively do as part of this, and this comes back to your point about maybe millennials needing to be, you know, trained and skilled, okay, is we actively look to empower and educate our clients as we go through the process. So again, traditional consultancy model is typically, as I've just said, and then be really protective of the knowledge and actually what makes things successful, because, and to a certain extent, that, you know, makes sense from your business model's perspective. Doesn't make sense if your client, you know, you're client orientated, because you want the client to be successful, right? And ideally, if you make the client successful and you do things well, you make yourself successful, and that's our kind of philosophy. So, what, as I said, what we broadly do is really focus on educating the client, which is very different to the old consultancy model. And if I tell you, clients love it, okay, especially government. So
that's interesting, because a lot of clients don't like it when you hold a mirror up. So even if they've come to you and said, I've got this problem, I need to do this, and you have a meeting with them and you say, okay, you've got this problem, you need to do this. And even if you're just repeating what they've said, there are times where clients are just furious with you for holding that mirror back up to them.
And
you're kind of like, well, hold on a second. You told me that this was the problem.
Yes.
And this is what you wanted me to fix. But now I'm repeating this back to you. You're not as keen that you want to fix it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you, we don't come across that quite so often, okay, in terms of... you know, are you fixing a particular aspect of the function of our business?
Mm-hmm.
You know, often when we tell our tale and we say, look, we've been through this, there's a sigh of relief in the C-level team that actually somebody's coming along to take the burden off of them,
mm-hmm.
okay? And especially when we replay it and mm-hmm. say, we are going to educate your teams, okay? And we can demonstrate that, you know, we can say, look, you may have employed some brilliant, and trust me, we came across loads of brilliant people who are a bit younger than us, in fact, much brighter than us, okay? Much more savvy in terms of, you know, some of the technologies and elements such as this. But the issue for some of the younger generation is what I've just said. It's how do you get it done?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we've had many times where, you know, a CEO has come to us and has said, yeah, we've got some brilliant digital people. And we go, yeah, I'm sure we do. And then they and I said, but, you know, when they spoke to you about this stuff, and I said, without being rude about it, did you get everything that they talked to you about? And they, a lot of them, when they start warming up and trust, you go, actually, quite a lot of it went over the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then I often say to them, do you want to get your own back? And they go, what do you mean? How do I get my own back? And they say, how are you going to do that? That's the only question back to these individuals. And that comes back to the complex change aspect. Mm-hmm. They don't have those skills yet. They will be scary as hell when they do, trust me. Right? They will be brilliant at what they're doing. But at the moment, there's a gap. And that's actually because, you know, prior to, you know, kind of, let's call it the digital revolution, which was about 10 years ago properly,
mm-hmm.
okay, there wasn't really too many pervasive technologies at that point. I mean, mm-hmm. digital was, the, you know, if we kind of call it the bit between us as humans and the technology, that interface.
Yeah.
That was fairly pervasive mm-hmm. in that respect. You know, big data has been along, mm-hmm. okay? Arguably blockchain,
mm-hmm.
arguably. So, and, you know, probably it will be more pervasive than it is today, just the way it operates. AI is the biggest one of all, okay?
Very topical right now.
Absolutely. And it, absolutely the right topical thing, because I actually say, you know, the lessons that people have learned through their digital transformation journey will be absolutely applicable to AI.
Mm-hmm.
But the benefits, if you do it correctly, of AI will dwarf what you're going to get through your digital mm-hmm. stuff. Okay.
And I think this is where I think people are missing a trick, because what's happening, like you said earlier, where people are worried about what's going to happen to their job, or, you know, AI is going to take over or whatever. Actually, the smart people are embracing AI to support what they're trying to do and using it for the tasks that actually, I don't know, like email, for example, they're trying to use it to yeah. sort their email, or they're trying to use it to do admin tasks, and then supplementing that with their knowledge and their experience. And they're going to be the winners out of this, not the people that sit and say, I'm scared, AI is going to take
I'm
over.
I'm scared of it. To be honest with you, I think, I think it's slightly broader than that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think those people who embrace AI are just going to be happier.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's a really strong statement to make, right? But, you know, for most of us, admin tasks and repetitive tasks are pretty boring. We mm-hmm. see them as a necessary evil to mm-hmm. be done. If AI can take that away, so I'm concentrating much more creative stuff, actually probably social stuff as well, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, things, you know, just because of the pace of change and the pressure people are under at work and all of mm-hmm. these type of stuff, some things go, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, there's only so much you can invest in. So
mm-hmm.
is it in creative tasks? Is it mm-hmm. actually in social development? Is it all of those type of things? If you can use something which gives you more time, then you can invest in this stuff, which hopefully you'll find much more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So not only do I think those people who embrace it are actually being better mm-hmm. in that regard, I think they will just get the benefits associated with it a lot more. And yeah. I think that's how people should view it, okay? Mm-hmm. If, again, they know how to do it.
Yeah.
And that's part of the process, right?
That is part of the process. And you see a lot more of that on social platforms now. Here's the 6 prompts I used with this AI tool to make a 6-figure business. Or, you know, this is how you can learn how to do things. I mean, I've certainly used it. So I've been doing some volunteer work for a local animal charity, and I've used it to create marketing plans because I didn't know how to create a marketing plan. Give me a marketing plan and a posting plan based on this subject. This is what I'm trying to achieve. Fantastic. I could have sat there for hours and tried to write all of that and made sure that I had all of the content to go in there.
Yeah.
But actually it suggested things that I hadn't even thought about.
No, completely.
And that is what it, and that's what it's doing for
so
you.
So we've done something very similar, right? So one of our core tenants you heard a little while ago was quality. You know, we're really quality orientated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and as a reflection of that, we haven't done it yet. We're in the process of it. We're going through, sounds really boring, ISO 9001 certification,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is quality orientation. Mm-hmm. Okay, now as part of that, alongside. We have to do this also for governmental activities. You have to have a very comprehensive policy suite.
Mm-hmm.
We did all that within about 2.5 weeks. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't have been able to do that within 2.5 weeks if we didn't have our friend ChatGPT to help us as part of the process.
Yep.
Now, it doesn't give you all the answers.
No.
But it will give you 80% of this mm-hmm. is what you should be thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got to apply that to your business mm-hmm. In the right way and make some calls on it. But it accelerated stuff so mm-hmm. much more.
And absolutely. If, you know,
it would have taken us 3 months to do that. Mm-hmm. It took 2.5 weeks.
Yeah. And, you know, it's simple things like documents. So you can put 2 documents in and say, you know, where's the differences between these 2 contracts? You know, if you're being asked to sign a recurring contract.
It's much easier to do it.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, and they're much more accurate than we are.
Absolutely.
In that regard, right? I mean, one of the, I mean, it's all of those type of scenarios. But, you know, one of the ones which caught our attention a little while ago, okay, and this was probably about 6 weeks ago, one of our guys who's a UXer, okay, mm-hmm. we set him a task, and it's a guy called Kai, and we said, Kai, okay, talk into ChatGPT and create a website, a transactional website, an e-commerce website, see if you can do it. 4 hours later, he said, I haven't touched the keyboard at all, and he said, what do you think of that website? And it was a completely full-functioning e-commerce website.
Wow.
That was 6 weeks ago. God knows what it can do now.
Yeah. Right. Well, I was at a conference the other day and they were talking about the fact that in our lifetime as human beings, if we read 24/7, we can take in 1 million types of different data, for example, 1 million points of data points. But AI is doing 1 billion every day.
Yes.
And so in the same time frame.
And self-learning.
So,
and I think, you know, the revolution, as we probably all know, 18 months ago, was the contextualization. So mm-hmm. it was a bit like Windows, right? Mm-hmm. Suddenly it became easy because AI is interrogation. It's a search algorithm, really. And it suddenly opened up because mm-hmm. before we'd have to go, oh, God, I don't want to have to work out the keyword string and what the Boolean structure is and all of that rubbish. And now you just say, actually, I'm going to ask it a question or type it a question. And it just goes, there you go. And it's amazing at it. So mm-hmm. it's that kind of, you know, language ability. So it just makes it so easy to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. And then you go, actually, I'm going to change my language a little bit more in that sense. So you add the ability to link it all together and just a much more simpler interface to be able to do it. And that unlocks stuff. And I think as part of that, what it really unlocked is also people's creativity around mm-hmm. it. So suddenly, as you said, you know, you've got the ability of a UX person saying, actually, I don't need a development team. I can just ask it to create this. It took 4 hours to mm-hmm. be able to do it. Actually, that's not very much time at all. Okay. Maybe in a week's time, it will be able to do it in an hour. Who knows?
Yep. Right?
Maybe Kai needs to just learn to ask it the right questions faster. But it is revolutionary.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's changing the whole of digital marketing because now we're into zero-click world.
Yeah.
Whereas before you would put something into Google and then you'd get your ads served to you. Do you remember when Google didn't have sponsored links and sponsored adverts and adverts all over the pages?
Yeah.
That's now where we are with AI tools.
It is. It's going full circle to a certain extent. In fact, interestingly, that was an organization called, let me get this right, I think it was GoTo, who started that model up.
Mm-hmm.
That was bought by Yahoo and then, you know, Google kind of adopted it and all that type of stuff within it. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the SEO environment has been changed radically within 12 months.
Yep. So how are we making money? And also, as a business, is your website obsolete? I mean, that's a really curious question, isn't it? Because if you're not selling specific products, so if it's not an e-commerce platform, but you're using it as a shop window to say, so for example, a gym business, so you've got your shop window to say, this is what happens at the gym. You can join up. And okay, there's a bit of e-commerce there because you can sign up online. But regardless of that, you know, is your website really necessary in this day and age?
It's a lot less important than it was.
Absolutely.
And it will increasingly become less important because at the moment, people still go to your website. So it's still important that you have one. Okay. Mm-hmm. But as people get weaned off of that and actually say, oh, I just need to look at it in this, actually what you're trying to do with your digital environment is to write for an AI engine.
Yep.
Because that's where the answers are going to get. And actually a lot more, I mean, your website is just a taxonomy, right, of content.
Mm-hmm.
And the AI engine is just going to go, right, it's that bit which is important. The rest is superfluous for that query that somebody's asked about. So that's the way you have to look at it these days. It isn't about actually how I get my link in Google up, you know, paying for it or whatever it is actually how do I ensure that the right information that I want to go here in that AI engine is displayed at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a big change of thought process, right? It's taken the SEO industry 20 years old and it's just ripped it up to a certain extent.
We've gone back to, so this is something that I used to do years ago on the side. I used to do SEO for websites. Now that was when it was quite easy and you just used to put keywords and you used to hide them in behind various
titles and other bits.
Yeah, exactly.
Metadata.
Yeah. So in the early 2000s, I suppose. But yes, you'd hide it. But we're back in that kind of scenario now in terms of we need to relearn how to do that. So we've gone down a bit of a rabbit hole with AI. Sorry, I think I'll steer us back a little bit. But talk to us a little bit about why you started DWG. Where did it come from?
Do you know, I think like most founders, it's something often which is really personal for them. They have a need that they need to do it, okay? And I was, after we blown, I was thinking about this. I was driving in the car up today and I was thinking, why do most founders start their kind of firms? Because you've got to be a little bit mental, I think, often to kind of do it, right? I think you've got to be a little bit mental and or a little bit naive. And if you're in that very small minority, maybe you are a genius. I'm definitely not a genius. So maybe it's in a certain other thing. But for me, it was a very personal thing, actually. So I had been in my, let's call it my corporate career, very fortunate, actually, to work in not scale-ups and startups, but high-growth digital businesses. Right. It was, you know, it's a bit like AI today. If you work for NVIDIA and all, I'm not going to take us down that rabbit hole. That was that type of environment. And I suddenly realized, you know, I was a bit of a high growth junkie. I quite liked that. Okay. It was fun. It was creative. It was a new industry. Business models hadn't been created and it was all created and all of that type of stuff. But it was really intense. So after about, I can't remember how long it was, 15 or 20 years, I think, you know, I thought I needed a break. So I stepped out of an organization I really loved, actually, and I was there at FreeServe for about 4 years. And I did one last kind of big project for them, program, which was really turning them from a kind of a pipe and a portal into a triple play environment. And that was pretty intense. Nobody had done it before. And it was, you know, I was very privileged to have gone through it, but it was a lot of hard work. Anyway, that came to a conclusion, got to the right thing. And I went, actually, I'm going to take some time off. And I actually took 9 months off, okay? I then scared myself because I loved it, doing nothing. And I was in my mid-30s at that point, and I thought, you know, what am I going to do next? And I thought, I know a bit about digital and the internet. I'll become an independent consultant. Mm-hmm. So I did that for 6 years, okay? And I learned, actually, one of the big realizations, because I worked a lot for scale-ups and startups. Mm-hmm. And I realized I knew very little about the internet and digital mm-hmm. in that period, because I'd been working for ISPs and, you know, mm-hmm. some e-commerce activity and all of that stuff. But it was a much bigger kind of beast than that activity. But to answer your question, why did I start DWG? It was because as an independent consultant, I got really lonely.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So working on, you know, I was very fortunate. I worked with some really good clients. Actually worked with some rubbish clients as well. had some challenges. That's probably a more more polite way of putting it. The good clients I had were, you know, they were good in terms of saying, oh, no, you're part of the team and all of that mm-hmm. type of activity. But you're never really part of the team as a consultant, mm-hmm. really, okay?
And for IR35 purposes, absolutely not.
No, of course. you know, they've reinforced that recently over the last few years. You know, you're definitely not part of the team at that point. And you can't go into the canteen. No, you're not allowed in the canteen. But, you know, as I said, psychologically, and I quite like working with teams of people and all mm-hmm. this thing. And I've been told in my corporate life that I wasn't too bad at doing that type of stuff. So I decided actually to start a business. And actually that was more enjoyable. I was thinking at the time it was going to be more enjoyable to start a business and grow a business. And it has been the case, okay, than actually just be a consultant. Mm-hmm. Because consultancy at a certain point can be a bit soulless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Can be lonely, as I've just said. Yep. But it also, you know, it's quite nice to be able to help somebody plan it and then execute it and see the benefits of it. Mm-hmm. Now, the old consultancy model, they typically said actually it's advisory mm-hmm. and we'll do the execution. Mm-hmm. And then you think, oh, I'm never going to see what the benefits were at that
because we'll palm off you off to the next team and then you can deal with
it. The next team or off to the next client or whatever mm-hmm. it was. And actually we shaped part of DWG's shape is to help plan and execute that kind of business outcome came from that. Mm-hmm. Let's not, you know, we recognize clients need the benefit associated, but also it's good for us. Mm-hmm. We don't want it to be soulless. We want to be part of the journey, right, and get the benefit. But for me, you know, the principal thing was actually I was fed up just working on my own. Mm-hmm. And I caught up actually with some other independent consultants I knew well at the hospital club in Endell Street, which isn't there anymore, sadly. And I said to them, you know, how's life as an independent consultant? And they went, oh, it's lovely. We love it. You know, there's no politics to stuff. We're mm-hmm. more in control of what we're doing and everything like that. And then said, and one of them said, how do you find it? And I said, well, it's all that. But I said, I'm really lonely at the moment, right? And I know it sounds a bit sad, but let's be truthful. Mm-hmm. That's how I kind of feel. And they went, oh, thank God you've cracked. We're really lonely too. And that is how it started. So it really started from that position. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that we'd obviously collectively quite quickly worked out as well is that we'd done a very, very poor job of thinking about our finances in the future.
Right? And perhaps your personal development as well, venture?
Possibly, and all of that type of thing. So we then thought, actually, if we build a business, if you're an independent consultant, you can earn well-ish mm-hmm. right, along the yeah. way. You have to deal with the feast and famine, but, mm-hmm. you know, if you applicable to the IR35 laws, you can, you know, you can earn relatively well. Mm-hmm. But you're never going to get that real cash out. You're never going to do that mm-hmm. in that period. So we also thought to ourselves, actually, maybe we should build a business that somebody would like to buy at some point in time. Mm-hmm. And that was the level of naivety that we kind of went into it with. So we thought, oh, okay, we're a bit lonely, so let's do something. And maybe we'll be able to create something that somebody at a certain point in time might find of value. And maybe we'll cash out. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm certain you've probably heard at least some of that. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You know, from some of the other, you know, people you've talked to over that period of time. The journey's probably been quite different. Mm-hmm. But the motivations in that regard, mm-hmm. that's how we kicked it off, mm-hmm. okay? Now, I think early doors we made some quite clever choices. Mm-hmm. And also we made some quite clever choices about not making a choice. I know that sounds oxymoronish, but that was true, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the biggest things we did to start with is we said we're not going to work for scale-ups and startups. We're only going to work for big businesses. Mm-hmm. And we were very fortunate that we were able to use our network to work for some pretty big brands to start with, you know, MasterCard, eBay, PayPal, and a bunch of other ones.
What made that decision, though? What kind of drove that decision to focus on big business rather than smallers?
I think it comes back to that point about trust. Mm-hmm. Okay. Due respect to, you know, owners of smaller businesses who are fabulous and whatever, if we go in as big reasons now, but at the time we thought, if we want to sell, you know, our services, and we were relatively expensive, okay, we want to sell our services, we're probably going to have to sell to large, mid-sized to larger businesses. Mm-hmm. And they will trust more if you've done work for MasterCard, mm-hmm. eBay, PayPal, whatever, than if you've done it for Acme Group, who mm-hmm. are about that big. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, was a good choice. Even today, you know, mm-hmm. logos are important.
They are, because as soon if I say to people, if people ask me, who have you worked with before? And if I said the client that I actually worked for, a lot of people would say who. Yeah. But if I then say, well, the clients through that client that I worked with.
Yes.
Are household names. You see them in the high street. You see them when you go on holiday. You see them absolutely everywhere. And as soon as I start saying those, oh yeah, I know who they are. It's recognition, isn't it? You know this better than I. But is it the rule of three in marketing? You have to see something three times before you recognize it, and five times before you trust it, or whatever.
Yeah,
whatever
it's all that. You know. You go back to what we do. It's a big investment and it's high risk. Mm-hmm. So you want to have somebody that you trust can do the job. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's a bonus if you like them. Okay. But fundamentally, you said, I've done it for MasterCard and I've done it for Visa and I've done it for Liberty Global and I've done it for HMRC and I've done it for all of these things. We've done it. Okay. People then go, they must be okay.
Yeah. They must know what they're talking about.
Even if we didn't. We must, you know, it must be, you mm-hmm. know, and that helps. So that was one of the, you know, one of the core things we did quite quickly. I think the other thing is we didn't work out a proposition for at mm-hmm. least 2 years. Mm-hmm. We just listened to what clients were telling us. Mm-hmm. And through that learning, we went, oh, well, that seems to be a theme, and that seems to be a theme, and that seems to be a theme. And actually, it provided the foundation for why we're good at what we do. Mm-hmm. Because clients were saying, oh, this digital stuff, don't really understand it. We don't have the skills to execute it. And then we went, oh, we can help you plan it and understand it and execute it. Mm-hmm. And there's a need in the market to do that. And we became really obsessed with thinking about it from the client lens. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's only so many lens that, you know, organizations mm-hmm. can think, you know, client lens, customer, if you want to call it that, financial lens, competitive mm-hmm. lens, whatever it is. We've chosen the client or the customer lens as king. And mm-hmm. the rest will follow. Mm-hmm. Some organizations look at it from their financial lens, mm-hmm. You know, and maybe that's more traditional consultancy. But fundamentally, that was another good choice of ours. Mm-hmm. But over, you know, you kind of fast forward 14 years, we've now finally really understand what we do well and actually probably why. And actually the suite of services that we provide to clients as well. We're really clear on it.
How many times has that changed in that 14 years, do you think? A subsequent question, is it a natural evolution?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think we've had 3 to 4 step changes, mm-hmm. and then we've had incremental change in between. And it's just honing the message more and more and more. You know, it's the old kind of adage, which is you have to really, really, really think about what, you know, and get really clear what you do mm-hmm. if you've only got half a page to write in. Mm-hmm. If you've got as many pages as you want, you could probably just ramble on about it.
That's right.
Right now, right?
Just to get into ChatGPT and ask it to do it in 200 words
I've never thought about that. We have done that. We did it in an AI-generated podcast, which was amazing. But we really become very clear on it. But yeah, no, it just takes iterations to do it. Mm. And as I said, maybe ChatGPT are just better at us than doing it. But we have finally, I think, at least for this iteration, mm-hmm. become quite clear on what this next iteration is. But it's an ever-evolving thing, especially what we do. Mm-hmm. Okay, the constant theme in it is change.
Mm-hmm.
The things which move up and down, it started at digital, and then you've got to add blockchain, and then you've got to add big data, and then you've got to add AI on top, and that's mm-hmm. the kind of the constant change. And then the suite of services that you offer within. And it's a very personal choice for mm-hmm. people. Do you, as we said earlier, do you niche it?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you have it a bit broader? Or do you go really broad?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't recommend for an SME a really broad offering. It's too difficult in mm-hmm. terms of feasibility. But in terms of, you know, kind of mid-broad and very niche, it's a personal choice.
Mm-hmm. You talked earlier about 94% success rate in terms of work. Does that feel like a good rate of success for you? I mean, I think it is, but I think it's interesting that you're honest about that in terms of, you know, it's not always successful, because real life things aren't always successful. You know, if you think about let's go back to your driving a car scenario. Every time you get in the car is different, right?
Yep.
And actually you might scrape your car. You might, as I did the other day and told Mark, I might have done something slightly different, went through a pothole and scraped my alloy, which obviously was not ideal. But things like that happen, don't they? You know, unexpected things happen.
You know, conditions or some idiot, you know, just frankly slams into the side of your car and there's nothing you could have done about it. It's just those type of things. You know, things get in the way, even really experienced people just at certain times can't deal with, mm-hmm. okay? Now, one of the hardest messages we have to give to some clients, okay, and we've had this not too often, but occasionally, you know, we've made other mistakes. You know, mm-hmm. for example, you know, we're still humans, right? And some of the team make mistakes even now, right?
Of course.
Not very often, but thankfully, and that's a good thing. But one of the key things is actually there are times where businesses are too far gone.
Mm-hmm.
They're just too far gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really tough thing to actually say to a group and just say, I'm really sorry, but we can't help you turn this around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we typically, you know, are often called in to help with a nice plan transformation, and we like that. Help with innovation, and mm-hmm. we really like that.
Mm-hmm.
But occasionally we're called in to turn around a business, because turning around a business is transformation on steroids. It's just, you have to be really clear, really prioritized. You know, this is the key things we're going to do at this mm-hmm. particular point. And you go into kind of a war situation and you're just getting stuff done. But some organizations are just too far gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll, you know, we will include that in our failure. Mm-hmm. Maybe we shouldn't, but we do
mm-hmm.
because we have, you know, we've been asked to do this and we've looked at it and we said, we will try, but the outcome is it can't be done. Well, we can do it at least.
Mm. And I think there's an element of, I would always say to business owners, is thinking about the clients that you want to work with and thinking about what's in it for the client, but what's in it for me?
Yeah.
And actually, is this going to be good business for me?
Yes.
Am I going to get paid? Is always a good word, good question to answer. Are we learning things here? Is there a proper synergy here, or am I taking it just for the money? And actually, if I'm taking it just for the money, is that all right? And can we live with that? Or do we need to think more holistically?
Yeah, I mean, we try and think more holistically. I think that's the key thing. Mm-hmm. I think over the last couple of years, when things have been very tough for a lot of businesses, I might change that slight advice for them and say, actually, sometimes you just have to do it for the money because mm-hmm. it's called survival, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think in normal conditions, you have to look at it more holistically. And you're right, it's what's in it for the client, but what's also in it for us.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as those two kind of concentric circles meet pretty well, that's actually where the magic kind of happens. But we're quite selective mm-hmm. in the type of clients we take on now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to give you, you know, kind of some parameters we work with, we don't really do much work outside of the UK.
Mm.
And people say to us, well, you know, why don't you chase stuff in Europe more mm-hmm. or America? Well, America's due to litigation, but that's a different story. It's because we're older. We just don't want to be traveling as much as we used to. Yep. We got family.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of work in the UK, or there is some work in the UK, so let's focus there. We also look at it in terms of kind of company size.
Mm.
Okay, so, you know, you said earlier, you know, working for small businesses can be really exciting, especially with the startups, and they're really, you know, creative. The trouble is they don't pay you.
No.
Right? So we don't typically work for clients any less than 50 million turnover.
Mm-hmm.
That's our kind of rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they've just secured 100 million of investment, then we'll happily work with them. But that's, you know, that's an exception. Conversely, we don't typically work with many companies, okay, where we don't know people in the business over a billion turnover because the sales process is too hard for us.
Mm-hmm.
We get bullied by bigger companies. Okay.
Yeah, and you end up with ridiculous payment terms of 120 days.
Or it takes 18 months to go through the governance process.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just too hard, right? It's really different, okay, because, you know, we're on the global PSL of MasterCard, we're on the European PSL of Visa, we're, you know, an approved supplier to the Financial Conduct Authority, right? But it's because we know people, or we've gone through an open tender process to achieve that, and it's a level playing field.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we actually, broadly, our parameters are 50 million to a billion turnover, and that's where we generally hunt.
Mm.
Obviously, if there's bigger, you know, those bigger businesses, we know people, or it's an open process, we'll clearly pursue that if we think we've got, that's a good thing to do. But ultimately, that's our choice. Mm-hmm. Because we think that's where we can do good business in that regard.
And I think you alluded to that there in terms of pitching for business. And that can often take time, but also resources as well, away from delivering other pieces of work. And it's always, I think, challenging, and I'd like to get your view on this. It's always challenging to know when to grow your team. And I always say to people, do it before you think you need to, because then you will have time to help them and train them. Because if you wait until you don't have time, then actually you're focusing on the wrong things. You won't have time to help train and coach them. That's my opinion. Doesn't have to be yours.
No, I agree 100%. You know, when you're growing a consultancy business, which is, you know, kind of demand and supply, which one do you major on first?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Do you know? And often people get sucked into a chicken and egg situation, right? We always say grow supply first and then try and build demand for exactly what you're saying, right? So, and we had this post-COVID bounce. So when we came out of the COVID situation, everybody had kind of recognized that those organizations which had been more successful were more digitally mature.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously everybody then went, oh, you know, more digital people. And frankly, if you could spell the word digital, you're in demand, right? So we went, we came out of COVID with a kind of in our consultancy business with a company size about 40 people.
Mm-hmm.
And our kind of historical utilization on that size was around about 80%. It's quite high, actually, historically. I mean, most consultants is about 70%. We're at 80%. The COVID bounce, okay, we went from 40 people to 70, trying to manage a 95 utilization rate through 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God, that was difficult.
Yep.
But exactly. So suddenly, you're in that scenario. Now, luckily, we brought on board some really good people, consultants who could get us through. But actually, one of the mistakes we made was some of them weren't culturally aligned to our business. And we won't do that again.
No. Because?
Because it's highly disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, again, we know why we're good. And you heard earlier that one of the things is we have the right behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And if people in the business are disruptive, and I'm not saying they were wrong in their opinions, but if they're not aligned with everybody else, you want a little bit of tension, but you don't want a huge amount of tension.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the reason why. So if you get some critical hires wrong, as you know better than I do, it can be really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only is it, it can be bad, it can be bad. I mean, we were lucky, right? It can be bad for your client, but it also can be bad for you because suddenly you're being sucked into stuff you're working out and it's got a huge opportunity cost associated with it.
Yeah.
And for me, that's the critical learning is it's a big opportunity cost associated with it. But also, secondly, you're having to deal ultimately with you can't stay in the business
because
you're not really fitting into the business. You've got to move on and do something else. And if you've got, you know, if you're half human, you want to do that the right way rather than anything else. It takes time, right?
Those discussions, I always find them very hard, regardless of whether somebody's the right fit or not for the organisation. It's always hard to have that conversation. I was talking with someone recently about transparency, and that's the important piece is, were you clear about what you wanted them to deliver and how you wanted them to deliver it? What are your values? What's your mission? How are you expecting people to behave?
Yeah, completely.
Because if you don't have those behaviours written down, if you don't talk about them in one-to-ones, in personal development plans, then how do you expect that individual to behave in the way that you want them to behave? Because you're not setting them the right framework to behave in and be successful.
Completely. And also, and it even starts early as well, doesn't it? That you're not clear that that's the type of person you need.
Mm-hmm.
And you just hire the wrong person because you're being, you know, in our case, you just say
speed.
And I'm focusing on, you know, kind of expertise and knowledge and everything like that rather than the other bit, which is also equally, if perhaps even more important. Okay. Mm-hmm. As I said, we were lucky it didn't impact our clients, but it definitely impacted us as a business in that regard. So big lesson learned, actually. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's all right to say no to business.
Absolutely.
Because actually, it's not the right business.
Mm-hmm.
But also, secondly, you can't deal with it well enough.
Okay? Absolutely.
It's going to cause you problems. Right?
Can we deliver this successfully? If the answer is yes, let's do it. If the answer is not sure, we should probably get some more people, still do it and see where you get to. But know what the plan is and understand it.
Exactly. But, you know, exactly what we've just said, I think. But if it's also going to cause you to get on paper the right people with the right knowledge, but they're not going to gel in your business, don't do it.
Absolutely. So one final question from me before we sign off for today. I'm sure that you've got lots of advice for various people wanting to start their business or perhaps have already started. But if you could think about one key thing that you would say to somebody if they came to you and said, I'm thinking about starting a business, what one piece of advice would you give them? This is like the ChatGPT question. You wish you had ChatGPT, don't you?
Yeah, can I say two things?
Go on then.
Oh, go on. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what the primary one I'd say, okay, is time it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's really difficult to do that, especially over the last 10 years as we've gone through kind of out of, you know, preparing for Brexit, getting into COVID, cost of living crisis, wars, political instability. It's really difficult to do it, right? But choose it when the market is getting better rather than when the market is not very good. Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely the right thing. Because you can be, if the market's not good, your chances of doing it just diminish quite a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. So try and time it well. You know, it's a bit like the hiring. You know, look at it, that actually think about doing it now, but the market will definitely, within the window of when you want to get going, is going to improve because all boats rise on a rising tide.
Yep.
Okay. So I definitely say that. Okay. And the other bit I'd say is be really certain you want to do it because it's bloody hard work.
It's really hard.
All right. And it's scary that you're going to, most people fail. You know,
it's a very small percentage that are successful. It's something between 3% and 5%. It might not even be 5% that actually succeed. And that is phenomenally crazy.
Yeah, 1 in 20.
Mm.
It's really, you know, so give yourself as much chance to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And also just recognize it's going to be really hard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You get lots of advice from people. But trust your own instincts, I think, is really important as well, because you might get conflicting advice because one flavor doesn't fit all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I would do that, but be absolutely certain you want to do it. Mm-hmm. Because if you're, because one of the attributes, I think, apart from madness at times, which really helps, is being resilient.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. All of the founders that I've had in to the pod have all said about resilience and that they feel like they're slightly mad sometimes. And I think that's very true for anybody starting any type of business. You have to be resilient because you don't know what's around the corner.
No, you don't.
We started a call handling business in October 2019 for specifically focused on the gym industry. And then COVID kicked off and all the gyms shut for over 9 months. So, you know, we at the time, it was a great time to start.
No, of course.
Because gym industry was booming in end of 2019, still at the beginning of 2020. But we could never have predicted that that pandemic was going to hit.
COVID was a black swan, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
It was just a black swan event. But I think even if it didn't happen, you still need resilience in this particular sense. Sure. And people have asked me before, and they said, what's your measure of success? And clearly money's one measure and how happy you are at a particular point is another measure and all those type of things. But, you know, if I mainly it boiled down to how many times a day do I ask myself, should I be doing something different?
Mm-hmm.
And right at the start when we kicked off, that was 20 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I probably now think about it once a month,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I've had a crappy day.
Yeah.
And we all have that, right?
Yeah.
At times something happens or a number of things happen in that regard. Maybe that's a measure as well. You know, it's that kind of little, you know, voice in your head going, do you really want to be doing this?
I think that is a great end to our podcast today. Thank you to Sid for joining us on the What's Your Problem podcast. You can listen on Spotify or watch on YouTube. We look forward to hearing your views.